From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, T.J. Lydon tells us how he became a neo-Nazi at the age of 14, joined the Hammerskin Nation, and went on to recruit teenagers and teach them how to use arms. After 15 years, he left the movement. Now he works with the Jewish human rights group, the Simon Wiesenthal Center. He speaks to schools, religious groups, and law enforcement groups about the beliefs and tactics of skinheads. That and more coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Radio News in Washington. I'm Corva Coleman. More bad news today for the White House. Two more Republican moderates have announced they will vote to impeach President Clinton later this week. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Representatives Jack Quinn and John McHugh, both of New York, announced today they have moved from the undecided to the favoring impeachment column. In a statement, Quinn said the issue is about principle, not politics, adding his decision is based on clear evidence of perjury and obstruction of justice. The White House has been counting on winning support from a group of some 30 Republican moderates to avoid becoming the first president in 130 years to be impeached by the House. But more than a half a dozen on that list announced they would vote to impeach yesterday, prompting former White House Chief of Staff Harold Ickes to call it a tidal wave moving against the president. Mr. Clinton returns from his Middle East trip tonight and has plans to meet with wavering lawmakers who wish to see him. Connecticut Republican Christopher Shays, who was once firmly opposed to impeachment, has sought such a meeting, saying he's having second thoughts. Brian Naylor, NPR News, the Capitol.
President Clinton left Israel a short time ago. He is returning to Washington after completing a brief Middle East tour. His visit failed to spur Israel to continue withdrawing troops from the West Bank, as the Y River Peace Accords call for. The Libyan parliament is now willing for two Libyan suspects to be tried on charges of blowing up a Pan Am jetliner over Scotland a decade ago. The trial is to be held in a neutral country. NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports from London.
The announcement was made in a statement read at the General People's Congress. The statement said the Congress was satisfied with the proposal that the two men, Abdel Basset Ali al-Megrahi and Lamin Khalifa Fima, be tried in the Netherlands. The two are accused by Britain and the United States of planting the bomb that blew Pan Am Flight 103 out of the sky over Lockerbie, Scotland, 10 years ago this month. Today's statement does not mean the pair will be handed over immediately. Libya is still demanding that if they are found guilty, they be returned to Libya to serve their sentences. The statement called for further talks on this. It asks all parties to resolve any obstacles that would prevent the suspect's appearance at the earliest possible time. Michael Goldfarb, NPR News, London.
Attorneys for former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet are appealing a British court ruling. The lawyers want to overturn the decision denying Pinochet diplomatic immunity from arrest. The attorneys point out one of the judges that decided Pinochet's case is closely affiliated with human rights group Amnesty International. That group lobbied to have Pinochet arrested. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 42 points at 8,737. In heavy trading, the Nasdaq is up nearly 30 points at 1,996. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market has gained and lost ground today. But after a string of losing sessions, there are signs the market may be able to keep its head above water today. NPR's Jack Spear has this live report.
After five straight down sessions in a row, including yesterday's 126-point plunge, blue-chip stocks are modestly higher at midday. Investors, many of whom sat on the sidelines yesterday, were pulled back into the market today by an announcement from General Electric, whose businesses range from plastic to the NBC television network, that it is predicting earnings could be up substantially next year. GE stock rose to more than $88 a share on that news today. There was also some government economic reports that painted a somewhat rosier picture for the economy. The Commerce Department announced today the government's main inflation gauge, the Consumer Price Index, barely budged in November, rising a scant 0.2%. Businesses reported the value of the inventory of unsold goods sitting on their shelves rose 0.3% in October. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Owings Corning Company says it has reached a settlement on almost all of its asbestos cases. Owens Corning, an insulation maker, says it'll make payments of about $1.2 billion on pending claims. These claims will be paid out in 1999 and 2000. Owens Corning says the settlement program will resolve more than 176,000 cases. Some brands of cereal are getting more expensive. Kellogg says it's boosting prices by 2.7% on the average box of cereal. The company says this is the first price increase in nearly 5 years. Some other brands will have their prices cut, but some cereals will see large price jumps of 6 to 11%. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, a place to satisfy existing curiosities and discover new ones. Location information at 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, T.J. Lydon, is a former neo-Nazi who now works for a Jewish group that fights against anti-Semitism. Lydon became a white supremacist at the age of 14 and remained one for 15 years. For most of that time, he was a member of the group Hammerskin Nation. Long after he dropped out of high school, he spent a lot of time around schools recruiting teenagers. After having children of his own, he left the Hammerskin Nation and now works with the Simon Wiesenthal Center and its Museum of Tolerance. The center is dedicated to Holocaust remembrance, human rights, and the defense of the Jewish people. Lydon speaks to schools, churches, law enforcement groups, and the military about the beliefs and tactics of skinheads. I asked him to describe the group he was in, Hammerskin Nation.
Originally, it was a group called American Firm, which eventually evolved in what is now known as Hammerskin Nation. Hammerskin Nation is the largest racist skinhead gang in the world.
And what are its beliefs?
Its beliefs are white separation until total annihilation of all those who are not white.
And who are some of the people who count as not white?
Everybody who's basically not white. Jews would be considered non-white, and basically, you know, black, Hispanic, Asians, or anybody had Indian blood mixed.
Mm-hmm. Was this a violent group?
Oh, extremely violent. Nearly every member I know that's ever been involved with Hammerskin Nation has either been in jail, or probably waiting trial.
Was there an initiation where you were required to do something violent?
In the original gang, we had jump-ins. Later on, they don't do that anymore. Now, basically, you have to just prove your violence over a period of time. And majority of the guys, there'll be some shootings, maybe a stabbing. That's how some of the kids are on the way in.
What is a jump-in?
Jump-in is when you get four or five guys standing around you, and basically they pound on you for about 2 minutes.
So they'd pound on
the new guy.
The initiate.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's to show his loyalty and his heart, how good he can fight and how good he can take a beating.
What did you have to do?
I did the jump in.
Mm-hmm.
That was a long time. I did that back when they were still doing jump ins, and then eventually they stopped them.
And once you became a member of Hammerskin Nation, did you have to prove that you could attack other people?
Oh yeah, I mean, when you became a member of Hammerskin Nation, if any member of Hammerskin Nation was attacked, you had to go out and take care of whoever did the attacking. Let's say it was another white power group, or say a black or Latino gang. You definitely had to go and settle the score.
So what are some of the things that you did?
Oh, beatings, drive-by shootings, stabbing.
You did drive-by shootings?
Yes.
Did you serve time for them?
No. Most of the time, when people do drive-by shootings, they never get caught for them. It's one of those things that you get away with all the time.
Were there types of people who you considered to be the best targets?
No, not really. I'd say, as like other gang members, about 90% of all my victims were white kids from my surrounding neighborhoods. Kids we had beefs with, kids we didn't like, kids who were anti-racist at the time I was involved with the racist movement.
It's kind of ironic, isn't it, that you're supposed to be hating blacks and Jews and Asians and Native Americans, and you're spending most of your time beating up other white kids from your neighborhood.
That's what usually happens. I mean, if you look at all the gangs, you know, the black gangs suck about black power, but yet the majority of the people they kill every day is other black kids. Latinos say La Raza, you know, the race all the time, but they're out there gangbanging and killing Latinos all the time. Usually you go after people you know best, and it's usually people, quote-unquote, I guess, your own race.
Now, you belong to a group that was about hating African Americans and hating Jews. Did you know any black people or Jewish people from your neighborhood or your school?
I only knew, like, when I was in junior high, I knew one black kid. That was it. Didn't associate with him much. I never met somebody I knew was Jewish. Never did. Not my entire life. I probably did, but they probably just didn't tell me that they were Jewish. I mean, it's not one of the things people come up in conversation. They don't usually walk up to you and say, "Hi, I'm Jewish." I mean, it's like somebody walking up saying, "Hi, I'm Christian," to somebody all the time.
So what was your hatred based on?
It was based on basically what people had told me, what I was reading as far as racist propaganda books. Basically, I got a lot of the racism stuff from older racists. And I'm talking like, of course, Hitler's book, Mein Kampf, Henry Ford's International Jew, books like these. It's very easy, you know. I mean, it's hard to pick up in your normal bookstore, but you can still find them.
Well, what are some of the things that more experienced racists had told you early on that you found very convincing?
Just using statistics, twisting the statistics. See, there's more blacks in prison. The blacks are definitely inferior because they're always out there killing each other. You don't see us whites out there doing it all the time, but yet we as skinheads were out there all the time beating up other white kids. I guess because we looked at it as we were doing the right thing. And they were doing the wrong thing. That, you know, you can always justify what you do, no matter what it is.
Did you believe that the Holocaust was a lie?
No, I knew the Holocaust existed. I knew that it was a fact. There's too much documentation, but as a good little racist that I was, I pushed the fact that it didn't happen. Especially now in Eastern Europe, where the Holocaust was never really taught to a bunch of kids. You got a whole group of people going over there saying, "Well, the Holocaust happened. This is what we have." And then you got a whole group of Holocaust deniers just say, "Hey, it never did happen." So now you got a 50-50 chance, I guess, with those kids over there, whether they're going to believe it or not.
Had you grown up with movies or records or books that gave you any more meaningful exposure to African Americans and Jewish people and Jewish culture, African American culture?
I mean, my mom has always been a devout Christian, never spouted anything racist that I've ever heard in my entire life.
Mm-hmm.
She listened to a lot of different, music. My dad was mostly into country and western. My mom listened to a lot of, you know, Motown and stuff like that. I just never liked it. I mean, I listened to it. I know all the songs even today because they were in my house. But, I mean, you know, I think I got a lot of most of my racism definitely came from the music I chose to listen to, which is a racist form of this music called Oi, which is out of England, and my friends. And that's where I got, I'd say, almost 90% of my racism. The other 10% came from my grandparents and probably my dad.
What was the music like?
Very, very heavy racial overtones. I mean, one of the songs goes, you gas all the niggers and I'll kill all the Jews. If you kill a commie, I'll kill a gypsy too. That's the way it starts out.
I don't think I've heard that on the radio. Where did you find the music? Is it very underground?
Oh, you can find it on the net. Go mm-hmm. on the internet and you can just find racist music like crazy. You can actually use your Visa or MasterCard to purchase it. You get, you know, numerous things. When I was involved with it, it was very hard. I mean, we just have to get, like, underground albums and then write to the album label, and then they'd send us a list of what albums they had. It was very, very hard. Now it's not. I mean, one record company last year sold over 50,000 copies of white power music in the United States alone. That's a lot of racist music going out there to kids. That's not counting the guys that, like, I would do. I mean, when I got racist music, I would make tons of cassette tapes, and I'd just drive by junior high or high school and throw them out to the kids. Now that kid goes home, he may not like the music, but if one of them does, there was a new recruit.
Were there racist music concerts?
Oh, yeah, definitely. They're happening all the time. There was ones that are in Racine, Wisconsin. Buffalo, New York just tried to have one, what we know about. I threw one. Oklahoma City has had a bunch of them. Matter of fact, I mean, I actually threw three racist rock and roll concerts. In Southern California area, there's usually anywhere on any given weekend night, a Friday or Saturday night, you could find one.
Tell me about one of the ones that you threw.
I threw one that was called, they called them an Aryan Fest. And I threw it out in the desert, out in the middle of California, out in the desert, over a weekend, 3-day weekend. I flew bands in from Europe. Two bands from Europe came in, band from Canada came down to play. A bunch of bands in Southern California played. Charged $30 a head for the weekend, and I got over 200 kids there.
So what happened at the concert in addition to the music?
Oh, the music basically, it was out there, it was like going crazy. We had some band members that were up there, you know, preaching, you know, talking about, you know, that there's going to be a race war, there's going to be a we're going to have to destroy the federal government. Just pumping the kids up is all it was. The kids will come and listen to music. Not necessarily do they want to come listen to some people to give a speech. You get a guy out there who says, oh, I'm going to have a speech and I want you to show up. You're going to hardly get any kids there. You say, okay, I'm going to give a speech and then afterwards we're going to have this band play. You get tons of kids there because the kids come to hear the bands and then they get the speech on top of it.
Now, you mentioned, you know, that a lot of the kids at your concerts would be people you'd like to recruit, but they weren't already full-fledged racist. Would you try to set up the concerts that you did in places where there wasn't a lot of competition with other events? I mean, in some cities, there's so many concerts. The idea of a concert wouldn't be that thrilling. I mean, you have your choice.
Well, right. But I mean, I did it in San Bernardino County, which has a open air venue kind of thing, which means you can just do it openly out in the middle of nowhere. That's what we did. Is we went out. I went to a guy, business. I said, do you guys have any property you guys want to rent? And he goes, well, what do you want to do? I said, oh, I want to have a birthday party out there. And I just need about 20 acres. And the guy rented me 20 acres of land. We went out there and we threw a big old concert. Now, for a lot of these kids, you know, it's when you put white only concert, a lot of kids will show up that are white just to go see what it's about. Some kids just, they don't even know what it is. And then they get out there and, you know, they don't see the guys in the Klan hoods. They don't see the sheets. They see some, you know, people yelling white power and stuff. But for a white kid, that's not going to bother him. I mean, what's he got to worry about? Just, you know. So it's a way of getting a lot of young potential recruit kids. Usually after an Aryan Fest or racist rock and roll concert, you will see in the surrounding communities, hate crimes usually jump. Matter of fact, where I did it, the area I did it, it's sad, but it still has a real problem up there still today.
If you're just joining us, my guest is T.J. Lydon. He's a former member of the white supremacist group Hammerskin Nation. He left that group and that world and now speaks out against hate groups and is a consultant for the Simon Wiesenthal Center's Tools for Tolerance program. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is T.J. Lydon. He's a former white racist, and now he consults to the Simon Wiesenthal Center Tools for Tolerance program, speaking to schools, churches, law enforcement groups, and the military about the beliefs and the tactics of skinhead groups. You know, one of the things I always wonder about people who are, you know, like professional racists is, how do you completely turn off your empathy toward other people? Like, what do you have to do to, like, not feel for the groups that you hate, not feel that they're human or anything?
Well, I mean, I got to a point that I guess I could put it in this kind of analogy. They get you to go to a certain point in life, and once you get to that certain point, you really lose any feeling you have for other people. I mean, do you have any children?
I don't.
So, I mean, say if you had, like, a niece or a nephew or you had a son or daughter, and somebody told you that there's a lion on the hill, and tomorrow that lion's going to come down and maul your child. That's just a fact that's going to happen. Now, to prevent that lion from mauling your child, you're going to go and get that lion and destroy it because you never want your child to go through that kind of physical pain or agony. In the same way, they say that all the races are the lions coming to attack the white children. So if you don't do something, your white child's never going to have a future.
Is that an analogy that was actually used for you?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. That was one of the analogies that even later on I started using.
Mm-hmm. Did you have children at the time it was used?
My wife at the time, somebody talked to me about it because I was talking about some of the things, was pregnant with my first son.
But you were already a racist then, weren't you?
I was already involved in the movement for quite some time.
Right.
But this is when they really wanted me to start to become a recruiter.
I see.
Out and recruit other kids.
Right, and to turn up your level of commitment.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you confident that you were better than the people that you hated?
Not always. I mean, I know there's... I would just tell people that I'm not better, as per se. I couldn't be as intelligent as somebody who was a black scientist who was in nuclear physics. I would just basically, it's because you can't do it as one person on one person. How they do it is they say, as a whole, our race is more intelligent, our race is smarter, our race is brighter. And then you get people that write books that say that, and it just even, you know, pumps. I mean, you get college professors that, you know, the bell curve. I mean, that book was like the Graces loved that book because they were able to go to high school kids and say, look, it's not just us that's saying it. We even got college professors and universities saying it. Look at these scientists. They're, you know, it's like that kind of crazy stuff like that where it just taints everything in existence.
How did you first join the racist group?
I first joined basically just through a bunch of older kids. I was going to a bunch of that time punk rock shows, hanging out. These guys saw me. They kind of liked my violence. I think they saw something
in
me.
They kind of liked your violence. What did they see of your violence?
Oh, I was starting to become a more violent person. My parents were going through a really nasty divorce. And instead of venting my frustration, I say the way my brother did. My brother went to football. My other brother started rebuilding cars and in auto shop. I basically just started venting on people. I started attacking people that would just make me angry or upset. And these guys who were older exploited it. They used it to their advantage.
So they saw that you had this potential for violence. And what did they do to recruit you?
Basically, just had me hang out. Just had me let me hang out with them, get involved with them, drink with them. I mean, for the first time in my life, I had older brothers. I'm the oldest, but now I had older brothers.
And what was appealing about what they were showing you and the whole lifestyle of belonging to the group?
Well, they said it was like it's a family. If anybody messes with you, they got to mess with all of us. If they attack you, they got you know, we're going to go after them. And if you go out there long enough, sooner or later, you will be attacked. If you dress like a gang member, sooner or later, a rival gang member is going to attack you. And when I got beat up one night and these guys went out and just literally almost, you know, killed one of the other gang members, and I figured, God, these guys have so much loyalty to me. Look, they're going to do this, so I got to do it back for them.
So you felt really good when they attacked the other guys on your behalf.
Right, exactly.
Did your parents know, did your brother know that you were joining this group?
I think both my younger brothers knew. My parents didn't know for almost 4 years what I was involved with.
Were they oblivious, or did you just hide it from them?
I hid it a little bit from them, but I think they also were oblivious. Not my son. My son can't be doing that. It's the same thing when somebody goes, you know, hey, your kid's on heroin. No, not my kid. It can't be. No. No. You got the wrong kid. And the kid ODs one night, and then they got to find out the hard way. My parents had to find out the hard way. You know, being arrested, getting in trouble, and then finally my mom calling the police department and asking some questions and then telling her the truth.
What was her reaction when she found out?
She was very sad. She was very upset. When I came home, everything I had in my room was out of my house. I mean, she literally packed up everything that was mine and put it in garbage bags and told me that I could leave it outside in my car, but I was not to bring the trash back in the house. And if I did, I'd be outside with the rest of the trash.
What was your reaction to that?
Well, I love my mother, and I respected her in her house, so I didn't bring the stuff back into her house.
So you went to live with gang members?
No, I stayed living at her house. She still allowed me to stay there.
Oh, she just didn't want the racist stuff in there.
Uh-huh. In the house.
Did this dissuade you at all from continuing with your beliefs in the violence? Or
No, it actually not at all. By the time they found out what I was involved with, nothing would have stopped me by that time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was 18 by this time. I got involved when I was 14. Mm-hmm. By the time I was 18, I was running. I was running the gang. I mean, in my area, I mean, I was second in command. And that was just, you know,
what did it mean to be second in command?
I controlled. I was recruiting at this time kids just to be vicious gang members. We were pumping the gang up. I mean, we went from a gang in like a week of only five kids to a gang of over 35 in about 6 months, and we basically did whatever the hell we wanted to do.
You said that, you know, you were second in command and you were recruiting a lot of other people to join the Hammerskin Nation. What were your techniques for recruiting people?
Well, in the early stages, when I was just recruiting for gang members, it's just about, you know, size. Just many kids as I could possibly get, whether they were good fighters or not. Just, we wanted numbers. Later on, I started using music, comic books. They have hardcore racial overtones and themes to them. You can walk into some comic book stores, and you're not going to believe the comic books you're going to find on the shelves that talk about white power and racism. And I mean, there's one that even says that World War II never even happened. It's incredible. Hitler's a good guy. I'd give them, you know, like stuff like that. I'd just talk to them. I'd become their friend. When a kid gets out of school at 2:30 in the afternoon and mom and dad don't get home until 7, 5 hours later, who's your kid talking to? I mean, if I'm spending 4.5, 5 hours a day with your son or daughter, who's more of an impactful and influential part of their lives?
Were there certain kinds of kids that you felt were most most easily persuaded?
Oh, well, you can always find the vulnerable kid. All kids are going to be vulnerable at a certain time. The majority of the kids we went at, there were between the ages of 12 and 14. That's their puberty stage. That's the time when they're going from a very concrete way of thinking to a very abstract way. You know, they're starting to get their adult brain, but they're not adults. They're not kids. They're kind of confused. And that's the time you would go after them the most. You hit them the hardest. Now, you know, this is an easy group to belong to. What do you got to be? I got to be white, and I got to hate everybody else. Oh, that's okay. That's cool. So now they're bang. They get involved. Other kids, you got to do more with them. Like I said, you got to give them comic books, CDs, videos. You got to spend time with them and talk with them and bring them along. There's just multiple things. The one kid that I always looked for was a kid that there's a group of 10 kids standing around. If he left and three of those kids followed him, I want the kid that walked away. And the kids followed him, because I know if I get him, his followers will follow him right into the racist movement at that time.
Did you know how to play on kids' insecurities? I mean, for instance, a lot of 12-year-olds are very insecure about going from boyhood to manhood. I mean, are they man enough? Would you work with that?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I get a 14-year-old kid, a 12-year-old kid, and you know, he'd be hanging out saying, "Hey, how you doing, man? How you doing today? Oh, we're doing okay, you know." But by the time that kid hit 14, you know, I just basically talked to him from 12 to 11. And when he hit 14, I said, "Hey, man, why don't you come over here and have a beer with us and the guys, man? You know, you're old enough, man. You're a man now." He's not a man. I mean, he's 14-year-old, man. He's barely, you know, wet behind the ears. But I'm going to treat him like a man. I'm going to give him the respect as a man as long as he earns the respect. Now, what's going to happen is he ain't going to do nothing until he's about 15, 16 years old. When he hits 15 or 16 years old, he's going to go out and start committing violent acts for us if he wants to keep being called a man and not be called a wuss.
T.J. Lydon is a former neo-Nazi who now works with the human rights group, the Simon Wiesenthal Center. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Little Brown & Company, publisher of Holiday on Ice by NPR commentator David Sedaris, available in paperback in bookstores nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, former neo-Nazi T.J. Lydon tells us how he began to question his beliefs. And we remember Judge Leon Higginbotham, who challenged racism within the legal system. He died yesterday at the age of 70. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with T.J. Leiden. He was a neo-Nazi for 15 years. For most of that time, he was a member of the group Hammerskin Nation. He started questioning his beliefs after he had children. He since renounced white supremacism and now works with the Simon Wiesenthal Center, which fights for human rights and the defense of the Jewish people. You know, I was going on the internet, just kind of looking at some of the white power websites, and I noticed that a lot of people seem to have nicknames like Octavian or Son of Odin. And I was wondering if that was part of the appeal, too, that you get a cool name, you get a cool exotic name.
Yeah, I mean, you once have like Wolfpack. They come up with really off-the-wall names. Anything that the derogatory or uses, they use terms like 88 and 14 in their name. Like Skinhead Girl 14 or Skinhead Girl 88, which basically means that they're white power. Most people don't know that the term 88, being the eighth letter of the alphabet, being H, means Heil Hitler. Hmm. And where I work at the Museum of Tolerance, we actually put a book out. It's called The Lexicon of Hate. And it actually gives people these symbolisms, these names, Rahoa, which stands for Racial Holy War. 14 means we must secure the existence of our race and a future for white children. Now, you won't know this off the bat, but they know it. Other races can pick it up and say, hey, that's a racist person. Now I can talk to him.
Did you have a nickname?
When I was involved? Mm-hmm. When I was online, I used to use one of the phrases, old skin, because I was one of the oldest skinheads I knew in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'd been involved for such a long time.
And that was a name that was supposed to get respect, I'd imagine.
Oh, it got a lot of respect from a lot of different people. A lot of different people.
Now, you joined the Marines. Did you think you'd be able to be a practicing white supremacist within the Marines?
I didn't really think about it. It didn't bother me. But when I got in, I was totally able to be a white power racist and be in the military.
Why'd you join?
Basically to get away from some of the trouble I was starting to get into.
What kind of trouble?
I was starting to get in trouble a lot. I started getting a reputation where the cops were coming after me. The cops were, like, seeing me. They'd pull me over. They'd stop me on the street. I went to jail. So I said, you know what? It's time for me to get out of here for a while and let everything cool off. So I joined the Marine Corps.
You said you were able to still be a white supremacist when you joined the Marines. I would imagine in some ways that the Marines might have been the first time that you were exposed to people who weren't white, you know, African Americans, Jewish people.
As a matter of fact, my commanding warrant officer was Jewish and my immediate superior was black inside the Marine Corps.
Well, let me just say, who weren't white by your standards? I just thought I'd better add that. Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, no, he was white and Jewish, but I mean, I had a swastika flag inside my wall locker. I mean, I had Hitler's book Mein Kampf, George Lincoln Rockwell, who was the founder of what was in the American Nazi Party. I had this stuff in my right there, open. I mean, they could see it every time they came into my room.
What would they say?
Nobody really ever said anything. Some people said, you know, we don't like that. It's not right. Never anything about, well, you got to pack it up and ship it home because you can't have it while you're in the Marine Corps. None of that. I mean, I had people coming by my sergeants, corporals, lieutenants that would come by my room and say, hey, you know, you got to watch Geraldo tonight. Some of your friends are on there. And they'd laugh about it.
Did that mean that they didn't take you seriously as a threat?
I think it was. I think they didn't take me very seriously as a threat. And then that, to my advantage, actually worked. I was able to recruit other people that were in the Marine Corps to join white power groups. I think a lot of them didn't see that, oh, he can't be a racist, because I would sit down with some people that were on the military base who were black and then actually work with them. But they were with, like, the Nation of Islam. They were black racists. So it was very easy. They say, well, he can't be racist. Look, he's talking to somebody black. Well, we had the same agenda. When I was involved in the racist movement, the black separatists and the white separatists had the same agenda. They want to separate the races. So, you know, it was very, very simple. And a lot of people, like you said, did not take it very seriously. And when they didn't take it seriously, eventually it became a very big problem. The Army didn't take their racist problems seriously, and they had the murder of the black couple in Fayetteville.
Did it challenge any of your views to actually be exposed to and to work with people who weren't like you?
Actually, what it did is the Marine Corps perfected my racism. It got me from being a street hoodlum and a street thug and just beating people up because of the color of their skin to where I actually started working with other groups of racists, black, Latino, Asians, who had the same goal as the white racists did of totally separating everybody on the planet, got me to read a lot more, got me to become more intellectual is what it did. It just basically rounded me out a lot better.
If it got you to be more intellectual, I would have thought it would have gotten you to challenge some of your own opinions.
At that time, it didn't, because at that time, I still basically figured that what I was doing was 100% correct and right, and there was no need to question it. There was no need to look at it as being wrong.
If you're just joining us, my guest is T.J. Lydon. He's a former white supremacist who now works against hate groups and consults to the Simon Wiesenthal Center's Tools for Tolerance program. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is T.J. Lydon. He's a former white supremacist. He now consults with the Simon Wiesenthal Center's Tools for Tolerance program, speaking to schools, church groups, law enforcement groups about the beliefs and the tactics of skinhead groups. You were married to a woman who, like you, was a white supremacist. Now, you had a baby. Were you trying to rear the baby according to white racist beliefs?
My oldest son, when he came home from the hospital, actually had a swastika flag over his crib. Most kids have mobiles. He had a swastika flag.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until then my second son came, and then in the room there was a swastika flag and a Confederate flag, both in the room. Now, this is when my second son was born, is when I slowly started to look at things differently. I started to question things that I hadn't been questioning for some time. I was still reading a lot of books. I do like to read. I do that quite often, even though I have a mild form of dyslexia. I have to read a book two or three times, but once I get the book, I get the book very, very well. So I really started to question a lot of things that I had been taking for granted for quite too long. And I started to get some of the answers, and some of the answers I got were not the answers I wanted to get.
What do you mean?
Well, I wanted to get the pad answered to keep my racism going and keep my racism flowing. Really, the reality was that's not the way it was working. It was actually going in the opposite direction. I was teaching my kids to be racist, educating them to be racist, but I didn't understand the extent of that I was doing it to them until my youngest son was saying stuff like, "I hate Jews. I hate the federal government. I hate," you know, he would say niggers. And then I'm sitting there going, you know, this kid doesn't even know what he's talking about, man. You know, he has no idea what he's even doing. I see. I was just totally indoctrinating my son.
Yeah, but isn't that what you wanted him to think, anyways?
Well, I wanted him to think that way, but I also wanted him to be a little more, I guess, an independent thinker. And then I also thought about what his life was going to be. I mean, if his life was his dad's life, man, that was really no life at all. I mean, it really wasn't. I mean, I was a glorified gang member is what I was. And he would have to go through the same aspects of gang life that I had to go through. And I didn't know if he could cut it.
What else were you exposed to that made you challenge this white supremacist beliefs that you'd held for so long?
I actually started talking with people that were black, Hispanic, talking to them about different issues. Talking about things I hadn't been talking to them before. I started getting back into Christianity and getting away from my paganistic beliefs and that.
Let me stop you. How did you start talking to African Americans and Latinos?
Just like at lunch counters during lunch break, just sitting down, and they'd sit down next to me, and we'd start carrying a conversation, talking to them in the work environment when I would, you know, go do my work, my business. And just talk to them there.
What was the last straw for you when you decided, okay, I'm going to leave this life, I'm going to leave this group?
Well, the last straw happened about a year before I actually left the movement. I was up at a place called Aryan Nations. This is a compound in northern Idaho. And I was up there and I asked a question, and not to just one, but to a couple of different people, but one to just a general assembly, I said, if we wake up tomorrow and everybody on this planet who's not white and Aryan just is dead, you know, we've miraculously won this race war we're all talking about. What is on our agenda? What's next in our plans? And now before anybody could answer, this young man, who's about 24, sitting next to me, hits me in the leg and says, TJ, you need to sit down, dude, because we're going to start with hair color next. Now, initially, I laughed, along with about everybody else in the room, about that statement. I went home. I was thinking about the statement, started thinking about eugenics and that, you know, only strong males allowed to mate with fruitful females. I started thinking about genetic coding and all this other stuff, and I realized that sooner or later, hair color and eye color would matter. Hair color and eye color did matter to the Nazis. If you were lighter and that meant you were higher on the chain. If you were darker and darker, well, you were on the bottom of the chain. So eventually, that chain's going to have a problem, and eventually they got to get rid of the problems in the chain. So that started to really make me think a lot more. And within a year's time from that straw being thrown in the camel's back and me actually talking a lot more then with different people, I decided that it was time for me to leave.
Was it hard to get out?
It was, well, for me, it was by the time I made the decision, no. Afterwards, it was when the death threats came.
Mm-hmm.
The web pages about how big of a race traitor I am.
Yeah, well, let me stop you. I found one of those web pages. It's, one of them's still up. It's like, I guess it's a picture of you. It says, "What's wrong with this picture?" And it says, "For those of you who don't know, that's TJ the butt plug Lyden, pronounced T-R-A-Y-T-U-R, traitor." And it says, "Notice first the swastika tattoo, then notice him standing proudly in front of the good old Wiesenthal Center. You tell me what's wrong with this picture." And then underneath it says, "A tribute to his mommy." And there's a picture of the international code for wheelchair. And then this is a moving picture. And then you could see a stick figure walking out from the wheelchair. What's that a reference to?
Well, my mom has polio. And she now has post-polio. And she is very, she's probably going to end up having to stop working very, very soon because her disability is getting more and more and more. So they put that on there as a dig to my mom.
Now, under Hitler's regime, she would have been seen as being inferior.
She would have been eliminated. End of story.
Is that something you ever thought about during your supremacist days?
I did a little bit, but I figured, you know, I could save my mom. She's my mom. I can save her. Nobody will do any damage to her because of who I am. Later on, as I started getting more and more into it, it didn't matter if she was my mom or not, man. If she's dead, she's dead. They don't care. They don't care if she's your mother, she's your kid. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter who you are. It matters who they are.
Let me get back to this thing on the web. I mean, are there a lot of threats still against you?
I still receive threats every once in a while. Not as much as I used to get, but I'll probably get a couple after the radio interview today. Usually, after I do an interview, I will get two or three. This station I'll probably get a lot more. Just because when they listen, that's when they call up and I'll get a death threat. Phone banks, there's what they call phone banks around the United States where people can call up and get a message from a racist recruiter. I'll probably be on them again. They'll probably put my phone number out again at my home, so I'll probably get some more racist calls at home. Emails, I'll get more emails saying, you know, you're a racist scum, you're a traitor, da-da-da-da-da, that kind of stuff.
What would you tell your friends within Hammerskin Nation when you were leaving? What would you tell them about why you changed your mind?
Basically, I just only told one person who was my best friend for, I'd say, nearly 13 years. We started in the movement at the same time. We're in the movement for about forever. And his only reaction was to me is that I'm going to kill you, you traitor. That's exactly what he said to me.
Did
I'll
he
kill
try?
You. So far, not him. I've had three incidents where people have tried to sneak a gun into where I was speaking one night at one of the colleges I was speaking at, and a couple other incidents of that have happened.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, I'm sure that they're going to continue to try, but I'm going to continue to speak out against the racist movement.
If you're just joining us, my guest is T.J. Lyden. He's a former skinhead, a former member of Hammerskin Nation, a white supremacist group. Now he speaks out against hate groups and consults with the Simon Wiesenthal Center. How did you get involved with the Simon Wiesenthal Center?
Well, my mom I'd seen Rabbi Heyer many, many times on the TV, and also Rabbi Abraham Cooper, and said that I should go down to the Museum of Tolerance. And I looked at my mom and said, Mom, are you smoking crack? Are you nuts? Mom, that's a Jewish place. I mean, I'm an ex-Nazi. Jews hate Nazis, even if you put an X in front of the word. I mean, I can't go down there. I'm not going to go down and get cussed out by them. But my mom kept at me, kept using the guilt trip and all me. So I basically wanted just to get her to shut up. So I called and told them who I was. And to my surprise, they actually wanted to talk to me. So I came in, I brought in all my racist material that I'd accumulated for 15 years, pictures, videotapes, CDs, everything I had, gave it to them. Went to the Church of Museum of Tolerance, a Holocaust section, ended up talking with the research department for 2.5 weeks about anything and everything I could about racism, what they planned, what they were doing, people in the movement, where they were at, what was up, and how they'd moved here, they'd done this, whatever I could help them with. After 2.5 weeks, I just went home. I was back running my business, working. I'm home for 10 days, and then I get a phone call from Rabbi Abraham Cooper, the associate dean, and he asked me to please come in. So I came in with my mom that day and talked to him and Rabbi Heyer, who's the dean and founder of the center, the Museum of Tolerance, talked to them for 12 hours, and that's when they asked me if I would please speak for the National Task Force Against Hate at the Simon Wiesenthal Center. I thought about it. I talked it over with every member of my family, talked it over with the rabbis a couple more times, and then I said I would actually do it. So since the last week of July of 1996, I literally haven't shut up. It's extremely interesting to me when I look at the people who have the most reason in the world to hate me, are Jewish people and the black people who lived through civil rights. Jewish Holocaust survivors are amazing to me. They befriend me. They thank me for what I'm doing now. People that lived through civil rights that were beaten and attacked, they come up to me and say, you know, thank God you're on our side now and you're helping. It's just amazing. The people that should really despise me the most are the ones who embrace me the most.
What about your feelings, though? Are there still occasional glimmers of your racism and anti-Semitism that you can't just, purge completely from your mind?
Well, I'm in professional psychology. I talk with a professional psychologist once a week. And talk to them about the issues. I mean, do I still have racist thoughts that come into my mind? Of course it does. I mean, you can't turn off 15 years of your life and say, I'm never going to have another racist thought again. I mean, everybody has racist thoughts. No matter, you know, how liberal they might be, those thoughts do come into your head from time to time. Whether you're saying, oh, look at that dumb old redneck, or, you know, oh, that whatever, those thoughts come into your head. So, I mean, I'm constantly fighting them. I'm dealing with them. I don't let that interfere with my friendships. My majority of my friends who are black, when I sit there and I talk to them and say, you know, every once in a while, you know, I'll see a young black kid on the street corner. I look at him, God, what a gang member. And then I think to myself, why did you think that? How do you know he's a gang member? How do you know he's just not a normal everyday kid? And then they say, well, heck, man, I see a white guy walking down the street with long hair, and I think he's a stoner. Maybe he's not. Because I guess the stereotypes that are just portrayed in society, we get these things. I mean, you know, when you think of white trash, you think of trailer parks. If you think of young black males, you think gang member. I mean, you know, they have the stereotype that, you know, well, if you get a really good deal, you Jewed somebody down. Or if you don't want to give somebody some money, they say, oh, what, are you Jewish? I mean, these are like bad stereotypes that are in society that give the racists fuel. It plants seeds in young minds to eventually these racists can cultivate them and make them grow, and hopefully they don't be in somebody like who I was.
Well, T.J. Lydon, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
T.J. Lydon is a former member of the neo-Nazi group Hammerskin Nation. He now works with the Simon Wiesenthal Center and its Museum of Tolerance. Coming up, we remember one of the country's most prominent African-American judges, Leon Higginbotham. He died yesterday at the age of 70. This is Fresh Air. Thank you.
Judge Leon Higginbotham dedicated much of his career to challenging racism through the law and to challenging racism within the legal system. He died yesterday at the age of 70 after a stroke. From 1990 to his retirement in 93, he was the chief judge of the Federal Appeals Court in Philadelphia. He was only the third black judge to have directed any one of the country's circuit courts. In 1964, he was named by President Johnson to the Federal District Court in Philadelphia, and in 1977, President Carter elevated him to the U.S. Court of Appeals. 2 years ago, he spoke with Fresh Air guest host Barbara Bogave. They discussed how he had to deal with institutional racism throughout his education.
You grew up in Trenton, New Jersey. Your mother was a maid, and your father was a factory worker. And you were the first student from your segregated grammar school to graduate to the academic track at Trenton's junior high. How did you accomplish that?
Well, you had to have second year Latin to enter the academic program at what was then called the Lincoln Junior High School, an all-black school. But since we did not have Latin, it would mean that I would have to go in the industrial program. But my mother went to see the principal. The principal said it couldn't be done because I had not had first-year Latin. My mother begged him to give me an opportunity, saying she was confident that I'd be able to make it. So I entered the academic program where I started with second-year Latin, not having had the first year.
That's not that easy, is it?
It certainly wasn't.
Well, what did your mother hope for you?
Well, my mother had a minimum education, maybe a maximum of sixth grade Virginia education. My mother was the most inspiring person I've ever known, and she disregarded the probability curve. My mother believed in America in a sense that even with all of its obstacles, that if you give your society the very, very best and that you're steadfast, that somewhere God will make a way. So that she convinced me from the time I was 3 or 4 years old to really give it nothing less than my best. And I think that having a mother who had that type of commitment had a profound impact on me so that I could face obstacles and not feel overcome.
Well, you got into Purdue University, and at that time there were 6,000 whites and 12 blacks, and they had a kind of segregated housing arrangement for the black students, which I imagine sounds quite wretched. You asked the president of the university for a section of any dorm just for the 12 of you that had some heat. What was his response?
Well, we slept in an attic with no heat. And you can imagine, and when the temperature got 20 and 15, how miserable. And his response was, look, Higginbotham, the law does not require us to have you here, and you either take it or leave it. And I finished my semester there, and I did well academically, and I transferred. And I did more than merely transfer from Purdue, which I'd entered when I was 16 and was studying engineering. I decided that I would go into the law because I wanted to, in my life, make a change so that my children would not face another president such as Dr. Elliott, who was willing to preclude us from equality at Purdue.
So he made you a lawyer?
He certainly did. I would have been an engineer but for him.
You graduated from Yale Law School. You were a star of the debate team. You had high recommendations, and the dean of the school sent you with recommendations to the Yale Law School representative in Philadelphia. Did the representative know you were black?
No, he did not. In fact, he wrote me a letter commending me on my record and said my problem would be to decide which firm I would want to go to. When I got there in December, when he met me, he didn't even ask me to sit down. He left me standing in front of his desk, and he said, well, Higginbotham, there's nothing I can do for you, but I can give you the name of two black lawyers And that was the end of the conversation. But I don't want to give a negative on all of these. Though all of the law firms refused to take me and refused a couple years earlier to take Bill Coleman, who had clerked for the United States Supreme Court Justice, I did have a great fortune in the sense that there was a Quaker judge, Judge Curtis Bach, who, when he got my papers, looked at them and hired me on the spot. And Judge Bach made a profound difference. He is the father of Derek Bach, the former president of Harvard, so that I would like for you to clearly understand that when I discuss the deficiencies in race relations in America, I am aware of many of the strengths, and I'm aware of the significant number of people of goodwill who have made a profound contribution into bridging the gaps so that the history of the past will not be the prologue of the future.
Judge Leon Higginbotham spoke with Fresh Air guest host Barbara Bogave in January of 1997. He died yesterday at the age of 70. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Alan Tu, with Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Sam Adams. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. ¶¶